Part 6. A Long Spoon. Therefore behoveth her a full long spoon that shall eat with a fiend. Geoffrey Chaucer, The Canterbury Tales, The Merchant's Tale. Chapter 89. Clarice Starling lies unconscious in a large bed beneath a linen sheet and a comforter. Her arms, covered by the sleeves of silk pajamas, are on top of the covers, and they are restrained with silk scarves, only enough to keep her hands away from her face and to protect the IV butterfly in the back of her hand. There are 3 points of light in the room, the low-shaded lamp, and the red pinpoints in the center of Dr. Lecter's pupils as he watches her. He is sitting in an armchair, his fingers steepled under his chin. After a time, he rises and takes her blood pressure. With a small flashlight, he examines her pupils. He reaches beneath the covers and finds her foot, brings it out from under the covers, and watching her closely, stimulates the sole with the tip of a key. He stands for a moment, apparently lost in thought, holding her foot gently as though it were a small animal in his hand. From the manufacturer of the tranquilizer's dart, he had learned its content. Because the second dart that struck Starling hit bone in her shin, he believes she did not get a full double dose. He is administering stimulant countermeasures with infinite care. Between ministrations to Starling, he sits in his armchair with a big pad of butcher paper doing calculations. The pages are filled with the symbols both of astrophysics and particle physics. There are repeated efforts with the symbols of string theory. The few mathematicians who could follow him might say his equations begin brilliantly and then decline, doomed by wishful thinking. Dr. Lecter wants time to reverse. No longer should increasing entropy mark the direction of time. He wants increasing order to point the way. He wants Misha's baby teeth back out of the stool pit. Behind his fevered calculations is the desperate wish to make a place for Misha in the world, perhaps the place now occupied by Clarice Starling. Chapter 90. Morning and yellow sunlight in the playroom at Muskrat Farm. The great stuffed animals with their button eyes regard the body of Cordell, covered now. Even in the middle of winter, a bluebottle fly has found the body and is walking over the covering sheet where blood has soaked through. Had Margot Verger known the raw ablative tension suffered by the principals in a media-ridden homicide, she might never have stuffed the eel down her brother's throat. Her decision not to try to clean up the mess at Muskrat Farm and to simply duck until the storm was over was a wise one. No one living saw her at Muskrat when Mason and the others were killed. Her story was that the first frantic call from the midnight relief nurse wakened her in the house she shared with Judy. She came to the scene and arrived shortly after the first sheriff's officers. The lead investigator for the sheriff's department, Detective Clarence Franks, was a youngish man with eyes a bit too close together, but he was not stupid as Margot had hoped he would be. "Can't just anybody come up here in that elevator? Takes a key to get in, right?" Franks asked her. The detective and Margot sat awkwardly side by side on the love seat. "I suppose so, if that's the way they came." "They, Miss Verger? You think there might be more than one?"
"I have no idea, Mr. Franks."
She had seen her brother's body still joined to the eel and covered by a sheet. Someone had unplugged the respirator. The criminalists were taking samples of aquarium water and taking swipes of blood from the floor. She could see in Mason's hand the piece of Dr. Lecter's scalp. They hadn't found it yet. The criminalists looked to Margot like Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Detective Franks was busy scribbling in his notebook.
"Do they know who those other poor people are?" Margot said. "Did they have families?"
"We're working it out," Franks said. "There are 3 weapons we can trace." In fact, the sheriff's department was not sure how many persons had died in the barn, as the pigs had disappeared into the deep woods, dragging with them the depleted remains for later. "In the course of this investigation, we may have to ask you and your long-time companion to undergo a polygraph examination. That's a lie detector. Will you consent to that, Miss Verger?"
"Mr. Franks, I'll do anything to catch these people. To specifically answer your question, ask me and Judy when you need us. Should I talk to the family lawyer?"
"Not if you don't have anything to hide, Miss Verger."
"Hide?"
Margot managed tears. "Please, I have to do this, Miss Verger." Frank started to put his hand on her massive shoulder and thought better of it. Chapter 91.
Starling woke in the fresh-smelling semi-dark, knowing in some primal way that she was near the sea. She moved slightly on the bed. She felt a deep soreness all over, and then she fell away from consciousness again. When next she woke, a voice was talking quietly to her, offering a warm cup. She drank from it, and the taste was similar to the herbal tea Map's grandmother sent her. Day and evening again. The smell of fresh flowers in the house, and once the faint sting of a needle. Like the thud and crackle of distant fireworks, the remnants of fear and pain popped on the horizon, but not close, never close. She was in the garden of the hurricane's eye. Waking, waking, calm. Waking in a pleasant room, a voice said. She heard faint chamber music. She felt very clean, and her skin was scented with mint, some ointment that gave a deep, comforting warmth. Starling opened her eyes wide. Dr. Lecter stood at a distance from her, very still, as he had stood in his cell when she first saw him. We are accustomed to seeing him unfettered now. It is not shocking to see him in open space with another mortal creature. Good evening, Clarice.
Good evening, Dr. Lecter, she said, responding in kind with no real idea of the time.
If you feel uncomfortable, it's just bruises you suffered in a fall. You'll be all right. I'd just like to be positive about something, though. Could you please look into this light?
He approached her with a small flashlight. Dr. Lecter smelled like fresh broadcloth. She forced herself to keep her eyes open as he examined her pupils, then he stepped away again.
Thank you. There's a very comfortable bathroom just in there. Want to try your feet? Slippers are beside your bed. I'm afraid I had to borrow your boots.
She was awake and not awake. The bathroom was indeed comfortable and furnished with every amenity. In the following days, she enjoyed long baths there, but she did not bother with her reflection in the mirror. So far was she from herself.
Chapter 92. Days of talk, sometimes hearing herself and wondering who was speaking with such intimate knowledge of her thoughts. Days of sleep and strong broth and omelets. And one day Dr. Lecter said, Clarice, you must be tired of your robes and pajamas. There are some things in the closet you might like, only if you want to wear them. And in the same tone, I put your personal things, your purse and your gun and your wallet, in the top drawer of the chest, if you want any of that.
Thank you, Dr. Lecter.
In the closet were a variety of clothes, dresses, pantsuits, a shimmery long gown with a beaded top. There were cashmere pants and pullovers that appealed to her. She chose 10 cashmere and moccasins. In the drawer was her belt and yaki slide, empty of the last 45, but her ankle holster was there beside her purse, and in it was the cut-down 45 automatic. The clip was full of fat cartridges, nothing in the chamber, the way she wore it on her leg. And her boot knife was there, in its scabbard. Her car keys were in her purse. Starling was herself and not herself. When she wondered about events, it was as though she saw them from the side, saw herself from a distance. She was happy to see her car in the garage when Dr. Lecter took her out to it. She looked at the wipers and decided to replace them.
Clarice, how do you think Mason's men followed us to the grocery store?
She looked up at the garage ceiling for a moment, thinking. It took her less than 2 minutes to find the antenna running crosswise between the back seat and the package shelf, and she followed the antenna wire to the hidden beacon. She turned it off and carried it into the house by the antenna, as she might carry a rat by the tail.
Very nice, she said. Very new. Decent installation, too. I'm sure it's got Mr. Crendler's prints on it. Might have a plastic bag.
Could they search for it with aircraft?
It's off now. They couldn't search with aircraft unless Crendler admitted he used it. You know he didn't do that. Mason could sweep with his helicopter. Mason is dead.
Starling said. Would you play for me? Chapter 93. Paul Crendler swung between tedium and rising fear in the first days after the murders. He arranged for direct reports from the FBI local field office in Maryland. He felt reasonably safe from any audit of Mason's books because the passage of money from Mason to his own numbered account had a fairly foolproof cutout in the Cayman Islands.
But with Mason gone, he had big plans and no patron. Margot Verger knew about his money, and she knew he had compromised the security of the FBI files on Lecter. Margot had to keep her mouth shut. The monitor for the autobeacon worried him. He had taken it from the engineering building at Quantico without signing it out. But he was on the entry log at engineering for that day. Dr. Domling and the big nurse Barney had seen him at Muskrat, but only in a legitimate role, talking with Mason Verger about how to catch Hannibal Lecter. General relief came to everyone on the fourth afternoon after the murders, when Margot Verger was able to play for the sheriff's investigators a newly taped message on her answering machine. The policeman stood rapt in the bedroom, staring at the bed she shared with Judy and listening to the voice of the fiend. Dr. Lecter gloated over the death of Mason and assured Margot that it was extremely painful and prolonged. She sobbed into her hand and Judy held her. Finally, Franks led her from the room, saying, "No need for you to hear it again." With the prodding of Krendler, the answering machine tape was brought to Washington and a voice print confirmed the caller was Dr. Lecter. But the greatest relief for Krendler came in a telephone call on the evening of the fourth day. The caller was none other than U.S. Representative Parton Velmore of Illinois. Krendler had only spoken to the congressman on a few occasions, but his voice was familiar from television. Just the fact of the call was a reassurance. Velmore was on the House Judiciary Subcommittee, and a notable shitepoke. He would fly from Krendler in an instant if Krendler was hot. "Mr. Krendler, I know you were well acquainted with Mason Verger." "Yes, sir." "Well, it's just a goddamn shame. That sadistic son of a bitch ruined Mason's life, mutilated him, and then came back and killed him. I don't know if you're aware of it, but one of my constituents also died in that tragedy. Johnny Mowgli served the people of Illinois for years in law enforcement." "No, sir, I wasn't aware of that. I'm sorry." "The point is, Krendler, we have to go on. The Vergers' legacy of philanthropy and their keen interest in public policy will continue. It's bigger than the death of one man. I've been talking to several people in the 27th District and to the Verger people. Margot Verger has made me aware of your interest in public service. Extraordinary woman. Has a real practical side. We're getting together very soon, very informal and quiet, and talk about what we can do next November. We want you on board. Think you can make the meeting?" "Yes, Congressman, definitely. Margot will call you with the details. It'll be in the next few days." Krendler put the phone down, relief washing over him. The discovery in the barn of the 45 Colt, registered to the late John Brigham, now known to be the property of Clarice Starling, was a considerable embarrassment to the Bureau. Starling was listed as missing, but the case was not carried as a kidnapping, as no living person saw her abducted. She was not even an agent missing from active duty. Starling was an agent on suspension whose whereabouts were unknown. A bulletin was issued for her vehicle with the VIN number and the license plate, but with no special emphasis on the owner's identity. Kidnapping commands much more effort from law enforcement than a missing persons case. The classification made Ardelia Mapp so angry she wrote a letter of resignation to the Bureau, then thought it better to wait and work from within. Again and again, Mapp found herself going to Starling's side of the duplex to look for her. Mapp found the Lecter VICAP file in the National Crime Information Center files maddeningly static, with only trivial additions. The Italian police had managed to find Dr. Lecter's computer at last. The Carabinieri were playing Super Mario on it in their recreation room. The machine had purged itself the moment investigators hit the first key. Mapp badgered everyone of influence she could reach in the Bureau since Starling disappeared. Her repeated calls to Jack Crawford's home were unanswered. She called behavioral science and was told Crawford remained in Jefferson Memorial Hospital with chest pains. She did not call him there. In the Bureau, he was Starling's last angel. Chapter 94. Starling had no sense of time. Over the days and nights, there were the conversations. She heard herself speaking for minutes on end, and she listened. Sometimes she laughed at herself, hearing artless revelations that normally would have mortified her. The things she told Dr. Lecter were often surprising to her, sometimes distasteful to a normal sensibility, but what she said was always true. And Dr. Lecter spoke as well, in a low, even voice. He expressed interest and encouragement, but never surprise or censure. He told her about his childhood, about Misha.
Sometimes they looked at a single bright object together to begin their talks. Almost always there was but a single light source in the room. From day to day the bright object changed. Today they began with a single highlight on the side of a teapot. But as their talk progressed, Dr. Lecter seemed to sense their arrival at an unexplored gallery in her mind. Perhaps he heard trolls fighting on the other side of a wall. He replaced the teapot with a silver belt buckle.
"That's my daddy's," Starling said. She clapped her hands together like a child.
"Yes," Dr. Lecter said. "Clarice, would you like to talk with your father? Your father is here. Would you like to talk with him?"
"My daddy's here? Hey, all right."
Dr. Lecter put his hands on the sides of Starling's head over her temporal lobes, which could supply her with all of her father she would ever need. He looked deep, deep into her eyes. "I know you want to talk privately. I'll go now. You can watch the buckle, and in a few minutes, you'll hear him knock. All right?"
"Yes. Super."
"Good. You'll just have to wait a few minutes." Tiny sting of the finest needle. Starling did not even look down. And Dr. Lecter left the room. She watched the buckle until the knock came. Two firm knocks. And her father came in as she remembered him. Tall in the doorway. Carrying his hat. His hair slicked down with water the way he came to the supper table.
"Hey, baby. What time do you eat around here?"
He had not held her in the 25 years since his death. But when he gathered her to him, the western snaps on his shirt front felt the very same. He smelled a strong soap and tobacco, and she sensed against her the great volume of his heart.
Hey, baby, did you fall down?"
It was the same as when he gathered her up in the yard after she tried to ride a big goat on a dare.
"You was doing pretty good till she swapped in so fast. Come on in the kitchen and let's see what we can find."
Two things on the table in the spare kitchen of her childhood home. A cellophane package of snowballs and a bag of oranges. Starling's father opened his Barlow knife with the blade broken off square and peeled a couple of oranges, the peelings curling on the oilcloth. They sat in ladder-back kitchen chairs, and he freed the sections by quarters, and alternately he ate one and he gave one to Starling. She spit the seeds in her hand and held them in her lap. He was long in a chair, like John Brigham. Her father chewed more on one side than the other, and one of his lateral incisors was capped with white metal in the fashion of 40s army dentistry. It gleamed when he laughed. They ate two oranges and a snowball apiece and told a few knock-knock jokes. Starling had forgotten that wonderful, squirmy feeling of springy icing under the coconut. The kitchen dissolved, and they were talking as grown people.
"How you doing, baby?"
It was a serious question. "They're pretty down on me at work."
"I know about that. That's that courthouse crowd, sugar. Sorry a bunch never drew breath. You never shot nobody you didn't have to."
"I believe that. There's other stuff."
"You never told a lie about it?"
"No, sir."
"You saved that little baby."
"He came out all right."
"I was real proud of that."
"Thank you, sir."
"Sugar, I gotta take off. We'll talk."
"You can't stay?" He put his hand on her head.
"We can't never stay, baby. Can't nobody stay like they want to."
He kissed her forehead and walked out of the room. She could see the bullet hole in his hat as he waved to her, tall in the doorway. Chapter 95. Clearly Starling loved her father as much as we love anybody, and she would have fought in an instant over a slur on his memory. Yet in conversation with Dr. Lecter, under the influence of a major hypnotic drug and deep hypnosis, this is what she said.
"I'm really mad at him, though. I mean, come on. How come he had to be behind a goddamn drugstore in the middle of the night going up against those two pissants that killed him? He sure chucked that old pump shotgun and they had him. They were nothing and they had him. He didn't know what he was doing. He never learned anything."
She'd have slapped the face of anybody else saying that. The monster sat back a micron in his chair. Ah, at last we've come to it. These schoolgirl recollections were becoming tedious. Starling tried to swing her legs beneath the chair like a child, but her legs were too long. See, he had that job. He went and did what they told him, went around with that damned watchman's clock, and then he was dead. Mama was washing the blood out of his hat to bury it with him. Who came home to us? Nobody. Damn few snowballs after that, I can tell you. Mama and me cleaning up motel rooms, people leaving wet Trojans on the nightstand. He got killed and left us because he was too goddamn stupid. He should have told those town jackasses to stuff the job. Things she would never have said. Things banned from her higher brain. From the beginning of their acquaintance, Dr. Lecter had needled her about her father, calling him a night watchman. Now he became Lecter, the protector of her father's memory. Clarice, he never wished for anything but your happiness and well-being. Wish in one hand and shit in the other one and see which one gets full the first, said Starling. This adage of the orphan's home should have been particularly distasteful coming from that attractive face. But Dr. Lecter seemed pleased, even encouraged. Clarice, I'm going to ask you to come with me to another room, Dr. Lecter said. Your father visited you as best you could manage. You saw that, despite your intense wish to keep him with you, he couldn't stay. He visited you. Now it's time for you to visit him. Down a hall to a guest bedroom, the door was closed. Wait a moment, Clarice. He went inside. She stood in the hall with her hand on the knob and heard a match struck. Dr. Lecter opened the door. Clarice, you know your father is dead. You know that better than anyone. Yes. Come in and see him. Her father's bones were composed on a twin bed, the long bones and rib cage covered by a sheet. The remains were in low relief beneath the white cover, like a child's snow angel. Her father's skull, cleaned by the tiny ocean scavengers off Dr. Lecter's beach, dried and bleached, rested on the pillow. Where was his star, Clarice? The village took it back. They said it cost $7. This is what he is. This is all of him now. This is what time has reduced him to. Starling looked at the bones. She turned and quickly left the room. It was not a retreat, and Lecter did not follow her. He waited in the semi-dark. He was not afraid. But he heard her coming back with ears as keen as those of a staked-out goat. Something bright metal in her hand. A badge. A star. John Brigham's star. She put it on the sheet. What could a star mean to you, Clarice? You shot a hole through one in the barn. It meant everything to him. That's how much he knew. The last word distorted and her mouth turned down. She picked up her father's skull and sat on the other bed, hot tears springing in her eyes and pouring down her cheeks. Like a toddler, she caught up the tail of her pullover and held it to her cheek and sobbed, bitter tears falling with a hollow tap-tap on the dome of her father's skull resting in her lap, his capped tooth gleaming.
I love my daddy. He was as good to me as he knew how to be. It was the best time I ever had.
And it was true, and no less true than before she let the anger out. When Dr. Lecter gave her a tissue, she simply gripped it in her fist, and he cleaned her face himself. Clarice, I'm going to leave you here with these remains. Remains, Clarice. Scream your plight into his eye holes, and no reply will come. He put his hands on the sides of her head. What you need of your father is here, in your head, and subject to your judgment, not his. I'll leave you now. Do you want the candles?
Yes, please.
When you come out, bring only what you need. He waited in the drawing room before the fire. He passed the time playing his theremin, moving his empty hands in its electronic field to create the music, moving the hands he had placed on Clarice Starling's head as though he now directed the music. He was aware of Starling standing behind him for some time before he finished his piece. When he turned to her, Her smile was soft and sad, and her hands were empty. Ever, Dr. Lecter sought pattern. He knew that, like every sentient being, Starling formed from her early experience matrices, frameworks by which later perceptions were understood. Speaking to her through the asylum bars so many years ago, he had found an important one for Starling, the slaughter of lambs and horses on the ranch that was her foster home. She was imprinted by their plight. Her obsessive and successful hunt for James Gunn was driven by the plight of his captive. She had saved him from torture for the same reason. Fine. Patterned behavior. Ever looking for situational sets, Dr. Lecter believed that Starling saw in John Brigham her father's good qualities, and with her father's virtues, the unfortunate Brigham was also assigned the incestual taboo. Brigham, and probably Crawford, had her father's good qualities. Where were the bad? Dr. Lecter searched for the rest of this split matrix. Using hypnotic drugs and hypnotic techniques much modified from Cameral therapy, he was finding in Clarice Starling's personality hard and stubborn nodes like knots in wood, and old resentment still flammable as resin. He came upon tableau of pitiless brightness, years old but well-tended and detailed, that sent limbic anger flashing through Starling's brain like lightning in a thunderhead. Most of them involved Paul Crandler. Her resentment of the very real injustices she had suffered at Crandler's hands was charged with the anger at her father that she could never, never acknowledge. She could not forgive her father for dying. He had left the family. He had stopped peeling oranges in the kitchen. He had doomed her mother to the commode brush and the pail. He had stopped holding Starling close, his great heart booming like Hannah's heart as they rode into the night. Crandler was the icon of failure and frustration. He could be blamed, but could he be defied? Or was Crandler and every other authority and taboo empowered to box Starling into what was, in Dr. Lecter's view, her little low-ceiling life? To him, one hopeful sign. Though she was imprinted with the badge, she could still shoot a hole through one and kill the wearer. Why? Because she had committed to action. Identified the wearer as a criminal and made the judgment ahead of time, overruling the imprinted icon of the star. Potential flexibility. The cerebral cortex rules. Did that mean room for Misha within Starling? Or was it simply another good quality of the place Starling must vacate? Chapter 96. Barney, back in his apartment in Baltimore, back in the round of working at Misericordia, had the 3-11 shift. He stopped for a bowl of soup at the coffee shop on his way home, and it was nearly midnight when he let himself into his apartment and turned on the light. Ardelia Mapp sat at his kitchen table. She was pointing a black semi-automatic pistol at the center of his face. From the size of the hole in the muzzle, Barney judged it was a .40 caliber. "Sit down, nursie," Mapp said. Her voice was hoarse, and around her dark pupils her eyes were orange. "Pull your chair over there and tip back against the wall." What scared him more than the big stopper in her hand was the other pistol on the placemat before her. It was a Colt Woodsman 22 with a plastic pop bottle taped to the muzzle as a silencer. The chair groaned under Barney's weight.
"If the chair legs break, don't shoot me. I can't help it,"
he said. "Do you know anything about Clarice Starling?"
"No."
Matt picked up the small caliber gun. "I am not fucking around with you, Barney. The second I think you're lying, nursie, I'm going to darken your stool. Do you believe me?"
"Yes."
Barney knew it was true. "I'm going to ask you again. Do you know anything that would help me find Clarice Starling? The post office says you had your mail forwarded to Mason Verge's place for a month. What the fuck, Barney?"
"I worked up there. I was taking care of Mason Verger, and he asked me all about Lecter. I didn't like it up there, and I quit. Mason was pretty much of a bastard."
"Starling's gone away."
"I know."
"Maybe Lecter took her. Maybe the pigs got her. If he took her, what would he do with her?"
"I'm being honest with you. I don't know. I'd help Starling if I could. Why wouldn't I? I kind of liked her, and she was getting me expunged. Look in her reports or notes or..."
"I have. I want you to understand something, Barney. This is a one-time-only offer. If you know anything, you better tell me now. If I
ever find out, no matter how long from now that you held out something that might have helped, I will come back here and this gun will be the last thing you ever see. I will kill your big ugly ass. Do you believe me?
Yes.
Do you know anything?
No.
The longest silence he could ever remember. Just sit still there until I'm gone. It took Barney an hour and a half to go to sleep. He lay in his bed, looking at the ceiling, his brow broad as a dolphin's, now sweaty, now dry. Barney thought about callers to come. Just before he turned out his light, he went into his bathroom and took from his dop kit a stainless steel shaving mirror, Marine Corps issue. He padded into the kitchen, opened an electrical switch box on the wall, and taped the mirror inside the switch box door. It was all he could do. He twitched in his sleep like a dog. After his next shift, he brought a rape kit home from the hospital. Chapter 97. There was only so much Dr. Lecter could do to the German's house while retaining the furnishings. Flowers and screens helped. Color was interesting to see against the massive furniture and high darkness. It was an ancient, compelling contrast, like a butterfly lit on an armored fist. His absentee landlord apparently had a fixation on Lita and the swan. The interspecies coupling was represented in no less than 4 bronzes of varying quality, the best a reproduction of Donatello, and 8 paintings. One painting delighted Dr. Lecter, and Anne Shingleton with its genius anatomical articulation and some real heat in the fucking. The others he draped. The landlord's ghastly collection of hunting bronzes was draped as well. Early in the morning, the doctor laid his table carefully for 3, studying it from different angles with the tip of his finger beside his nose, changed candlesticks 2, and went from his damask placemats to a gathered tablecloth to reduce to more manageable size the oval dining table. The dark and forbidding sideboard looked less like an aircraft carrier when high service pieces and bright copper warmers stood on it. In fact, Dr. Lecter pulled out several of the drawers and put flowers in them, in a kind of hanging gardens effect. He could see that he had too many flowers in the room and must add more to make it come back right again. Too many was too many, but way too many was just right. He settled on 2 flower arrangements for the table, a low mound of peonies in a silver dish, white as snowballs, and a large, high arrangement of massed bells of Ireland, Dutch iris, orchids, and parrot tulips that screened away much of the table's expanse and created an intimate space. A small ice storm of crystal stood before the surface plates, but the flat silver was in a warmer to be laid at the last moment. The first course would be prepared at table, and accordingly he organized his alcohol burners, with his copper fétue, his saucepan and sauté pan, his condiments, and his autopsy saw. He could get more flowers when he went out. Clarice Starling was not disturbed when he told her he was going. He suggested she might like to sleep. Chapter 98. In the afternoon of the 5th day after the murders, Barney had finished shaving and was patting alcohol on his cheeks when he heard the footsteps on the stairs. It was almost time for him to go to work. A firm knock. Margot Verger stood at his door. She carried a big purse and a small satchel. Hi, Barney. She looked tired.
Hi, Margot. Come in.
He offered her a seat at the kitchen table.
Want a Coke?
Then he remembered that Cordell's head was driven into a refrigerator, and he regretted the offer. No thanks, she said. He sat down across the table from her. She looked over his arms as a rival bodybuilder, then back to his face.
You okay, Margot?
I think so, she said.
Looks like you don't have any worries. I mean, from what I read.
Sometimes I think about the talks we had, Barney. I kind of thought I might hear from you sometime. He wondered if she had the hammer and the purse or the satchel.
Only way you hear from me. Maybe I'd like to see how you're doing sometime, if that's okay. Never asking for anything. Margot, you're cool with me.
It's just, you know, you worry about loose ends. Not that I've got anything to hide. He knew then she had the semen. It was when the pregnancy was announced, if they managed one, that she'd be worried about Barney.
I mean, it was a godsend, his death. I'm not going to lie about that. The speed of her talk told Barney she was building momentum. Maybe I would like a Coke, she said.
Before I get it for you, let me show you something I've got for you. Believe me, I can put your mind at rest and it'll cost you nothing. Take a second. Hold on.
He picked a screwdriver out of a canister of tools on the counter. He could do that with his side to Margot. In the kitchen wall were what appeared to be two circuit breaker boxes. Actually, one box had replaced the other in the old building, and only the one on the right was in service. At the electrical boxes, Barney had to turn his back to Margot. Quickly, he opened the one on the left. Now he could watch her in the mirror taped inside the switchbox door. She put her hand inside the big purse. Put it in, didn't take it out. By removing four screws, he was able to lift out of the box the disconnected panel of circuit breakers. Behind the panel was the space within the hollow wall. Reaching carefully inside, Barney removed a plastic bag. He heard a hitch in Margot's breathing when he took out the object the bag contained. It was a famous, brutish visage. The mask Dr. Lecter had been forced to wear in the Baltimore State Hospital for the criminally insane to prevent him from biting. This was the last and most valuable item in Barney's cache of Lecter memorabilia. Whoa, Margot said. Barney placed the mask face down on the table on a piece of waxed paper under the bright kitchen light. He knew Dr. Lecter had never been allowed to clean his mask. Dried saliva was crusted inside the mouth opening. Where the straps attached to the mask were three hairs, caught in the fastenings and pulled out by their roots. A glance at Margot told him she was okay for the moment. Barney took from his kitchen cabinet the rape kit. The small plastic box contained Q-tips, sterile water, swatches, and clean pill bottles. With infinite care, he swabbed up the saliva flakes with a moistened Q-tip. He put the Q-tip into a pill bottle. The hairs he pulled loose from the mask and put them in a second bottle. He touched his thumb to the sticky sides of two pieces of scotch tape, leaving a clear fingerprint each time, and taped the lids on the bottles. He gave the two containers to Margot in a baggie.
Let's say I got in some trouble and I lost my mind and I tried to roll over on you. Say I tried to tell the police some story on you to beat some charges of my own. You have proof there that I was at least an accomplice in the death of Mason Verger, and maybe did the whole thing myself. At the least, I supplied you with the DNA.
You'd get immunity before you ratted.
For conspiring, maybe, but not for physically taking part in a big publicity murder. They promised me use immunity on conspiracy, and then fuck me when they figured I helped. I'd be screwed forever. It's right there in your hands.
Barney was not positive of this, but he thought it sounded pretty good. She could also plant the Lecter DNA on Barney's still form any time she needed to, and they both knew it. She looked at him for what seemed like a very long time with her bright blue butcher's eyes. She put the satchel on the table. A lot of money in there, she said. Enough to see every Vermeer in the world once. She seemed a little giddy and oddly happy. I've got Franklin's cat in the car. I gotta go. Franklin and his stepmother and his sister Shirley and some guy named Stringbean and God knows who else are coming out to Muskrat when Franklin gets out of the hospital. Cost me $50 to get that fucking cat. It was living next door to Franklin's old house under an alias. She did not put the plastic bag in her purse. She carried it in her free hand. Barney guessed she didn't want him to see her other option in the purse. At the door, he said,
Think I could have a kiss?
She stood on tiptoe and gave him a quick kiss on the lips. That'll have to do, she said primly. The stairs creaked under her weight going down. Barney locked his door and stood for minutes with his forehead against the cool refrigerator. Chapter 99. Starling woke to distant chamber music and the tangy aromas of cooking. She felt wonderfully refreshed and very hungry. A tap at her door, and Dr. Lecter came in wearing dark trousers, a white shirt, and an ascot. He carried a long suit bag and a hot cappuccino for her.
Did you sleep well?
Great, thank you.
The chef tells me we'll dine in an hour and a half.
Cocktails in an hour, is that all right? I thought you might like this. See if it suits you. He hung the bag in the closet and left without another sound. She did not look in her closet until after a long bath, and when she did look, she was pleased. She found a long dinner gown in cream silk, narrowly but deeply décolleté beneath an exquisite beaded jacket. On the dresser were a pair of earrings with pendant cabochon emeralds. The stones had a lot of fire for an unfaceted cut. Her hair was always easy for her. Physically, she felt very comfortable in the clothes. Even unaccustomed as she was to this level of dress, she did not examine herself long in the mirror, only looking to see if everything was in place. The German landlord built his fireplaces oversized. In the drawing room, Starling found a good-sized log blazing. She approached the warm hearth in a whisper of silk. Music from the harpsichord in the corner. Seated at the instrument, Dr. Lecter in white tie. He looked up and saw her, and his breath stopped in his throat. His hand stopped too, still spread above the keyboard. Harpsichord notes do not carry, and in the sudden quiet of the drawing room, they both heard him take his next breath. Two drinks waited before the fire. He occupied himself with them. Lillet with a slice of orange. Dr. Lecter handed one to Clarice Starling. If I saw you every day forever, I'd remember this time. His dark eyes held her whole. How many times have you seen me that I don't know about? Only three. But here is outside of time. But what I may see taking care of you does not compromise your privacy. That's kept in its own place with your medical records. I'll confess it is pleasant to look at you asleep. You're quite beautiful, Clarice. Looks are an accident, Dr. Lecter. If comeliness were earned, you'd still be beautiful. Thanks. Do not say thanks. A fractional turn of his head was enough to dash his annoyance like a glass thrown in the fireplace. I say what I mean, Starling said. Would you like it better if I said, I'm glad you find me so? That would be a little fancier and equally true. She raised her glass beneath a level prairie gaze, taking back nothing. It occurred to Dr. Lecter in the moment that with all his knowledge and intrusion, he could never entirely predict her or own her at all. He could feed the caterpillar. He could whisper through the chrysalis. What hatched out followed its own nature and was beyond him. He wondered if she had the 45 on her leg beneath the gown. Clarice Starling smiled at him then. The cabochons caught the firelight, and the monster was lost in self-congratulation at his own exquisite taste and cunning. Clarice, dinner appeals to taste and smell, the oldest senses and the closest to the center of the mind. Taste and smell are housed in parts of the mind that precede pity, and pity has no place at my table. At the same time, playing in the dome of the cortex like miracles illumined on the ceiling of a church, are the ceremonies and sights and exchanges of dinner. It can be far more engaging than theater. He brought his face close to hers, taking some reading in her eyes. I want you to understand what riches you bring to it, Clarice, and what your entitlements are. Clarice, have you studied your reflection lately? I think not. I doubt that you ever do. Come into the hall, stand in front of the pier glass. Dr. Lecter brought a candelabrum from the mantel. The tall mirror was one of the good 18th century antiques, but slightly smoky and crazed. It was at her Chateau Beau-le-Vicomte, and God knows what it has seen. Look, Clarice, that delicious vision is what you are. This evening you will see yourself from a distance for a while. You will see what is just. You will say what is true. You have never lacked the courage to say what you think, but you've been hampered by constraints. I will tell you again, pity has no place at this table. If remarks are passed that are unpleasant in the instant, you will see that context can make them something between droll and riotously funny. If things are said that are painfully true, then it is only passing truth and will change. He took a sip of his drink. If you feel pain bloom inside you, it will soon blossom into relief. Do you understand me?
No, Dr. Lecter, but I remember what you said. Damn, a bunch of self-improvement. I want a pleasant dinner. That, I promise you. He smiled, a sight that frightened some. Neither looked at her reflection now in the clouded glass. They watched each other through the burning tapers of the candelabrum, and the mirror watched them both. Look, Clarice. She watched the red sparks pinwheel deep in his eyes and felt the excitement of a child approaching a distant fair. From his jacket pocket, Dr. Lecter took a syringe. The needle, fine as a hair, and never looking, only feeling, he slipped the needle into her arm. When he withdrew it, the tiny wound did not even bleed. What were you playing when I came in? She asked. If love now reigned. It's very old. Henry VIII composed it about 1510. Would you play for me? She said. Would you finish it now? Chapter 100. The breeze of their entry into the dining room stirred the flames of the candles and the warmers. Starling had only seen the dining room and passage, and it was wonderful to see the room transformed, bright, inviting, tall crystal repeating the candle flames above the creamy napery at their places, and the space reduced to intimate size with a screen of flowers shutting off the rest of the table. Dr. Lecter had brought his flat silver from the warmer at the last minute, and when Starling explored her place setting, she felt in the handle of her knife an almost feverish heat. Dr. Lecter poured wine and gave her only a tiny amuse-gueule to eat for starters, a single Belon oyster and a morsel of sausage, as he had to sit over half a glass of wine and admire her in the context of his table. The height of his candlesticks was exactly right. The flames lit the deeps of her décolleté, and he did not have to be vigilant about her sleeves. What are we having? He raised his finger to his lips. You never ask. It spoils the surprise. They talked about the trimming of crow quills and their effect on the voice of a harpsichord, and only for a moment did she recall a crow robbing her mother's service cart on a motel balcony long ago. From a distance, she judged the memory irrelevant to this pleasant time, and she deliberately set it aside. Hungry? Yes. Then we'll have our first course. Dr. Lecter moved a single tray from the sideboard to a space beside his place at the table and rolled a service cart to tableside. Here were his pans, his burners, and his condiments and little crystal bowls. He fired up his burners and began with a goodly knob of Charente butter in his copper faitu saucepan, swirling the melting butter and browning the butterfat to make beurre noisette. When it was the brown of a hazelnut, he set the butter aside on a trivet. He smiled at Starling, his teeth very white. Clarice, do you recall what we said about pleasant and unpleasant remarks, and things being very funny in context? That butter smells wonderful. Yes, I remember. And do you remember who you saw in the mirror? How splendid she was. Dr. Lecter, if you don't mind my saying so, this is getting a little Dick and Jane. I remember perfectly. Good. Mr. Krendler is joining us for our first course. Dr. Lecter moved the large flower arrangement from the table to the sideboard. Deputy Assistant Inspector General Paul Krendler, in the flesh, sat at the table in a stout oak armchair. Krendler opened his eyes wide and looked about. He wore his runner's headband and a very nice funeral tuxedo with integral shirt and tie. The garment being split up the back, Dr. Lecter had been able to sort of tuck it around him, covering the yards of duct tape that held him to the chair. Starling's eyelids might have lowered a fraction, and her lips slightly pursed as they sometimes did on the firing range. Now Dr. Lecter took a pair of silver tongs from the sideboard and peeled off the tape covering Krendler's mouth. Good evening again, Mr. Krendler. Good evening. Krendler did not seem to be quite himself. His place was set with a small tureen. Would you like to say good evening to Miss Starling? Hello, Starling. He seemed to brighten. I always wanted to watch you eat. Starling took him in from a distance, as though she were the wise old pier glass watching. "Hello, Mr. Crandler." She raised her face to Dr. Lecter, busy with his pans. "How did you ever catch him?"
"Mr. Crandler is on his way to an important conference about his future in politics," Dr. Lecter said. "Margot Verger invited him as a favor to me. Sort of a quid pro quo." Mr. Crandler jogged up to the pad in Rock Creek Park to meet the Verger helicopter, but he caught a ride with me instead. "Would you like to say grace before our meal, Mr. Crandler?"
"Mr. Crandler?"
"Grace? Yes." Crandler closed his eyes. "Father, we thank thee for the blessings we are about to receive, and we dedicate them to thy service. Starling is a big girl to be fucking her daddy, even if she is Southern. Please forgive her for that, and bring her to my service. In Jesus' name, amen."
Starling noted that Dr. Lecter kept his eyes piously closed throughout the prayer. She felt quick and calm. "Paul, I have to tell you, the Apostle Paul couldn't have done it better. He hated women, too. He should have been named Apol."
"You really blew it this time, Starling. You'll never be reinstated."
"Was that a job offer you worked into the blessing? I never saw such tact."
"I'm going to Congress."
Crandler smiled unpleasantly.
"Come around the campaign headquarters. I might find something for you to do. You could be an office girl. Can you type and file?"
"Certainly."
"Can you take dictation?"
"I use voice recognition software," Starling said. She continued in a judicious tone. "If you'll excuse me for talking shop at the table, you aren't fast enough to steal in Congress. You can't make up for a second-rate intelligence just by playing dirty. You last longer as a big crook's gopher."
"Don't wait on us, Mr. Crandler," Dr. Lecter urged.
"Have some of your broth while it's hot."
He raised the covered potager and straw to Crandler's lips. Crandler made a face.
"That soup's not very good."
"Actually, it's more of a parsley and thyme infusion," the doctor said, "and more for our sake than yours. Have another few swallows and let it circulate."
Starling apparently was weighing an issue, using her palms like the scales of justice. "You know, Mr. Crandler, every time you leered at me, I had the nagging feeling I had done something to deserve it." She moved her palms up and down judiciously, a motion similar to passing a slinky back and forth. "I didn't deserve it. Every time you wrote something negative in my personnel folder, I resented it. But still, I searched myself. I doubted myself for a moment and tried to scratch this tiny itch that said Daddy knows best."
"You don't know best, Mr. Crandler. In fact, you don't know anything."
Starling had a sip of a splendid white burgundy and said to Dr. Lecter,
"I love this, but I think we should take it off the ice."
She turned again, attentive hostess, to her guest.
"You are forever an oaf and beneath notice," she said in a pleasant tone. "And that's enough about you at this lovely table. Since you are Dr. Lecter's guest, I hope you enjoy the meal."
"Who are you, anyway?"
Crandler said.
"You're not Starling. You've got the spot on your face, but you're not Starling."
Dr. Lecter added shallots to his hot brown butter, and at the instant their perfume rose, he put in minced caper berries. He set the saucepan off the fire and set his sauté pan on the heat. From the sideboard, he took a large crystal bowl of ice-cold water and a silver salver and put them beside Paul Crandler.
"I had some plans for that smart mouth," Crandler said, "but I'd never hire you now. Who gave you an appointment anyway?"
"I don't expect you to change your attitude entirely as the other Paul did, Mr. Crandler," Dr. Lecter said. "You are not on the road to Damascus, or even on the road to the Verger helicopter."
Dr. Lecter took off Crandler's runner's headband, as you would remove the rubber band from a tin of caviar.
"All we ask is that you keep an open mind."
Carefully, using both hands, Dr. Lecter lifted off the top of Crandler's head, put it on the salver, and removed it to the sideboard. Hardly a drop of blood fell from the clean incision, the major blood vessels having been tied and the others neatly sealed under a local anesthetic, and the skull sawn around in the kitchen a half hour before the meal. Dr. Lecter's method in removing the top of Crandler's skull was as old as Egyptian medicine, except that he had the advantage of an autopsy saw with cranial blade, a skull key, and better anesthetics. The brain itself feels no pain. The pinky-gray dome of Crandler's brain was visible above his truncated skull. Standing over Crandler with an instrument resembling a tonsil spoon, Dr. Lecter removed a slice of Crandler's prefrontal lobe, then another, until he had four. Crandler's eyes looked up as though he were following what was going on. Dr. Lecter placed the slices in the bowl of ice water, the water acidulated with the juice of a lemon in order to firm them.
"Would you like to swing on a star?" Crandler sang abruptly. "Carry moonbeams home in a jar."
In classic cuisine, brains are soaked and then pressed and chilled overnight to firm them. In dealing with the item absolutely fresh, the challenge is to prevent the material from simply disintegrating into a handful of lumpy gelatin. With splendid dexterity, the doctor brought the firmed slices to a plate, dredged them lightly in seasoned flour, and then in fresh brioche crumbs. He grated a fresh black truffle into his sauce and finished it with a squeeze of lemon juice. Quickly, he sautéed the slices until they were just brown on each side.
"Smells great," Crandler said.
Dr. Lecter placed the browned brains on broad croutons on the warmed plates and dressed them with the sauce and truffle slices. A garnish of parsley and whole caper berries with their stems and a single nasturtium blossom on watercress to achieve a little height completed his presentation.
"How is it?"
Crandler asked once again behind the flowers and speaking immoderately loud as persons with lobotomies are prone to do.
"Really excellent," Starling said. "I've never had caper berries before."
Dr. Lecter found the shine of butter sauce on her lip intensely moving. Crandler sang behind the greens, mostly daycare songs, and he invited requests. Oblivious to him, Dr. Lecter and Starling discussed Misha. Starling knew of the doctor's sister's fate from their conversations about loss, but now the doctor spoke in a hopeful way about her possible return. It did not seem unreasonable to Starling on this evening that Misha might return. She expressed the hope that she might meet Misha.
"You could never answer the phone in my office. You sound like a cornbread country cunt,"
Crandler yelled through the flowers. "See if I sound like Oliver Twist when I ask for more," Starling replied, releasing in Dr. Lecter glee he could scarcely contain. A second helping consumed most of the frontal lobe, back nearly to the premotor cortex. Crandler was reduced to irrelevant observations about things in his immediate vision, and the tuneless recitation behind the flowers of a lengthy lewd verse called Shine. Absorbed in their talk, Starling and Lecter were no more disturbed than they would have been by the singing of Happy Birthday at another table in a restaurant. But when Crandler's volume became intrusive, Dr. Lecter retrieved his crossbow from a corner. "I want you to listen to the sound of this stringed instrument, Clarice." He waited for a moment of silence from Crandler and shot a bolt across the table through the tall flowers. That particular frequency of the crossbow string, should you hear it again in any context, means only your complete freedom and peace and self-sufficiency, Dr. Lecter said. The feathers and part of the shaft remained on the visible side of the flower arrangement and moved at more or less the pace of a baton directing a heart. Crandler's voice stopped at once, and in a few beats, the baton stopped too. "It's about a D below middle C," Starling said.
"Exactly."
A moment later, Crandler made a gargling sound behind the flowers. It was only a spasm in his voice box caused by the increasing acidity of his blood, he being newly dead.
"Let's have our next course," the doctor said. "A little sorbet to refresh our palates before the quail." "No, no, don't get up. Mr. Crandler will help me clear, if you'll excuse him."
It was all quickly done. Behind the screen of the flowers, Dr. Lecter simply scraped the plates into Crandler's skull and stacked them in his lap. He replaced the top of Crandler's head, and, picking up the rope attached to a dolly beneath his chair, towed him away to the kitchen. There, Dr. Lecter rewound his crossbow. Conveniently, it used the same battery pack as his autopsy saw. The quail skins were crisp and they were stuffed with foie gras. Dr. Lecter talked about Henry VIII as composer, and Starling told him about computer-aided design and engine sounds, the replication of pleasing frequencies. Dessert would be in the drawing room, Dr. Lecter announced. Chapter 101. A souffle and glasses of Chateau Yquem before the fire in the drawing room, coffee ready on a side table at Starling's elbow. Fire dancing in the golden wine, its perfume over the deep tones of the burning log. They talked about teacups and time and the rule of disorder. And so I came to believe, Dr. Lecter was saying, that there had to be a place in the world for Misha, a prime place vacated for her. And I came to think, Clarice, that the best place in the world was yours. The firelight did not plumb the depths of her bodice as satisfactorily as the candlelight had done, but it was wonderful playing on the bones of her face. She considered a moment. Let me ask you this, Dr. Lecter. If a prime place in the world is required for Misha, and I'm not saying it isn't, what's the matter with your place? It's well occupied, and I know you would never deny her. She and I could be like sisters. And if, as you say, there's room in me for my father, why is there not room in you for Misha? Dr. Lecter seemed pleased, whether with the idea or with Starling's resource is impossible to say. Perhaps he felt a vague concern that he had built better than he knew. When she replaced her glass on the table beside her, she pushed off a coffee cup, and it shattered on the hearth. She did not look down at it. Dr. Lecter watched the shards, and they were still. I don't think you have to make up your mind right at this minute, Starling said. Her eyes and the cabochons shone in the firelight. Aside from the fire, the warmth of the fire through her gown, and there came to Starling a passing memory. Dr. Lecter, so long ago, asking Senator Martin if she breastfed her daughter. A jeweled movement turning in Starling's unnatural calm. For an instant, many windows in her mind aligned and she saw far across her own experience. She said, Hannibal Lecter, did your mother feed you at her breast? Yes. Did you ever feel that you had to relinquish the breast to Misha? Did you ever feel you were required to give it up for her? A beat. I don't recall that, Clarice. If I gave it up, I did it gladly. Clarice Starling reached her cupped hand into the deep neckline of her gown and freed her breast, quickly, peaky in the open air. You don't have to give up this one, she said. Looking always into his eyes, with her trigger finger she took warm Chateau Yquem from her mouth, and a thick, sweet drop suspended from her nipple like a golden cabochon and trembled with her breathing. He came swiftly from his chair to her, went on a knee before her chair, and bent to her coral and cream in the firelight, his dark, sleek head. Chapter 102. Buenos Aires, Argentina, 3 years later. Barney and Lillian Hirsch walked near the obelisk on the Avenida Nueve de Julio in the early evening. Miss Hirsch is a lecturer at London University on sabbatical. She and Barney met in the Anthropology Museum in Mexico City. They like each other and have been traveling together 2 weeks, trying it a day at a time, and it is getting to be more and more fun. They are not getting tired of one another. They had arrived in Buenos Aires too late in the afternoon to go to the Museo Nacional, where a Vermeer was on loan. Barney's mission to see every Vermeer in the world amused Lillian Hirsch, and it did not get in the way of a good time. He had seen a quarter of the Vermeers already, and there were plenty to go. They were looking for a pleasant café where they could eat outside. Limousines were backed up at the Teatro Colón, Buenos Aires' spectacular opera house. They stopped to watch the opera lovers go in. Tamerlane was playing with an excellent cast, and a Buenos Aires opening night crowd is worth seeing. Barney,
You up for the opera? I think you'd like it. I'll spring.
It amused him when she used American slang.
If you'll walk me through it, I'll spring,
Barney said.
You think they'll let us in?
At that moment, a Mercedes Maybach, deep blue and silver, whispered up to the curb. A doorman hurried to open the car. A man, slender and elegant in white tie, got out and handed out a woman. The sight of her raised an admiring murmur in the crowd around the entrance. Her hair was a shapely platinum helmet, and she wore a soft sheath of coral frosted with an overlayer of tulle. Emerald splashed green at her throat. Barney saw her only briefly through the heads of the crowd, and she and her gentleman were swept inside. Barney saw the man better. His head was sleek as an otter, and his nose had an imperious arch like that of Perron. His carriage made him seem taller than he was.
Barney, oh, Barney, Lillian was saying, when you come back to yourself, if you ever do, tell me if you'd like to go to the opera, if they'll let us in Mufti. There, I said it, even if it's not precisely apt. I've always wanted to say I was in Mufti.
When Barney did not ask what Mufti was, she glanced at him sidelong. He always asked everything.
Yes,
Barney said absently.
I'll spring.
Barney had plenty of money. He was careful with it, but not cheap. Still, the only tickets available were in the rafters among the students. Anticipating the altitude of his seats, he rented field glasses in the lobby. The enormous theater is a mix of Italian Renaissance, Greek, and French styles, lavish with brass and gilt and red plush. Jewels winked in the crowd like flashbulbs at a ball game. Lillian explained the plot before the overture began, talking in his ear quietly. Just before the house lights went down, sweeping the house from the cheap seats, Barney found them, the platinum blonde lady and her escort. They had just come through the gold curtains into their ornate box beside the stage. The emeralds at her throat glittered in the brilliant house lights as she took her seat. Barney had only glimpsed her right profile as she entered the opera. He could see the left one now. The students around them, veterans of the high-altitude seats, had brought all manner of viewing aids. One student had a powerful spotting scope so long that it disturbed the hair of the person in front of him. Barney traded glasses with him to look at the distant box. It was hard to find the box again in the long tube's limited field of vision, but when he found it, the couple was startlingly close. The woman's cheek had a beauty spot on it, in the position the French call courage. Her eyes swept over the house, swept over his section, and moved on. She seemed animated and in expert control of her coral mouth. She leaned to her escort and said something, and they laughed together. She put her hand on his hand and held his thumb.
Starling,
Barney said under his breath.
What?
Lillian whispered. Barney had a lot of trouble following the first act of the opera. As soon as the lights came up for the first intermission, he raised his glass to the box again. The gentleman took a champagne flute from a waiter's tray and handed it to the lady and took a glass himself. Barney zoomed in on his profile, the shape of his ears. He traced the length of the woman's exposed arms. They were bare and unmarked and had muscle tone in his experienced eye. As Barney watched, the gentleman's head turned as though to catch a distant sound, turned in Barney's direction. The gentleman raised opera glasses to his eyes. Barney could have sworn the glasses were aimed at him. He held his program in front of his face and hunkered down in his seat to try to be about average height.
Lillian,
he said,
I want you to do me a great big favor.
She said, if it's like some of the others, I'd better hear it first.
We're leaving when the lights go down. Fly with me to Rio tonight. No questions asked.
The Vermeer in Buenos Aires is the only one Barney never saw. Chapter 103. Follow this handsome couple from the opera? All right, but very carefully. At the Millennium, Buenos Aires is possessed by the tango and the night has a pulse. The Mercedes, windows down to let in the music from the dance clubs, purrs through the Recoleta district to the Avenida Alvear and disappears into the courtyard of an exquisite Beaux-Arts building near the French Embassy. The air is soft, and a late supper is laid on the terrace of the top floor, where the servants are gone. Morale is high among the servants in this house, but there is an iron discipline among them. They are forbidden to enter the top floor of the mansion before noon, or after service of the first course at dinner. Dr. Lecter and Clarice Starling often talk at dinner in languages other than Starling's native English. She had college French and Spanish to build on, and she has found she has a good ear. They speak Italian a lot at mealtimes. She finds a curious freedom in the visual nuances of the language. Sometimes our couple dances at dinner time. Sometimes they do not finish dinner. Their relationship has a great deal to do with the penetration of Clarice Starling, which she avidly welcomes and encourages. It has much to do with the envelopment of Hannibal Lecter, far beyond the bounds of his experience. It is possible that Clarice Starling could frighten him. Sex is a splendid structure they add to every day. Clarice Starling's memory palace is building as well. It shares some rooms with Dr. Lecter's own memory palace. He has discovered her in there several times. But her own palace grows on its own. It is full of new things. She can visit her father there. Hannah is at pasture there. Jack Crawford is there, when she chooses to see him, bent over his desk. After Crawford was home for a month from the hospital, the chest pains came again in the night. Instead of calling an ambulance and going through it all again, he chose simply to roll over to the solace of his late wife's side of the bed. Starling learned of Crawford's death during one of Dr. Lecter's regular visits to the FBI public website to admire his likeness among the 10 most wanted. The picture the Bureau is using of Dr. Lecter remains a comfortable two faces behind. After Starling read Jack Crawford's obituary, she walked by herself for most of the day, and she was glad to come home at evening. A year ago, she had one of her own emeralds set in a ring. It is engraved inside with AMCS. Ardelia Mapp received it in an untraceable wrapper with a note. Dear Ardelia, I'm fine and better than fine. Don't look for me. I love you. I'm sorry I scared you. Burn this. Starling. Mapp took the ring to the Shenandoah River where Starling used to run. She walked a long way with it clutched in her hand, angry, hot-eyed, ready to throw the ring in the water, imagining it flashing in the air and the small plop. In the end, she put it on her finger and shoved her fist in her pocket. Mapp doesn't cry much. She walked a long way until she could be quiet. It was dark when she got back to her car. It is hard to know what Starling remembers of the old life, what she chooses to keep. The drugs that held her in the first days have had no part in their lives for a long time, nor the long talks with a single light source in the room. Occasionally, on purpose, Dr. Lecter drops a teacup to shatter on the floor. He is satisfied when it does not gather itself together. For many months now, he has not seen Misha in his dreams. Someday, perhaps, a cup will come together. Or somewhere, Starling may hear a crossbow string and come to some unwilled awakening, if indeed she even sleeps. We'll withdraw now, while they are dancing on the terrace. The wise Barney has already left town, and we must follow his example. For either of them to discover us would be fatal. We can only learn so much and live.